Hi, everyone. This is Dr. Cheryl Selman. Thank you for joining me for another hour on What Women Must Know. We have a great conversation in store for you. And as always, it's a pleasure to have you with me. It's a pleasure to be able to share profound information that will transform your life. There's no doubt about it. So this show is all about empowering you with truthful information so you can make the most informed decisions possible regarding your health and well-being. Today, we're going to be talking about a subject that personally I'm really passionate about, and that has to do with understanding how our biochemistry can heal our brain. And we have with us today Dr. William Walsh, who is a highly esteemed researcher in the field of our brain chemistry. He is the author of a fantastic book called Nutrient Power, Heal Your Biochemistry and Heal Your Brain. Just let me tell you a little bit about Dr. Walsh. He is president of the nonprofit Walsh Research Institute in Illinois and directs physician training programs internationally, including in Australia and Norway. Dr. Walsh has authored more than 200 scientific articles and reports and has 5 patents. He has presented his experimental research at the American Psychiatric Association, the U.S. Senate, the National Institutes of Mental Health, and has been a speaker at 28 international conferences. He has developed biochemical treatments for patients with behavioral disorders, ADHD, autism, depression, anxiety disorders, schizophrenia, and Alzheimer's disease that are used by doctors throughout the world. Dr. Walsh is lifting the veil on what I believe is the ignorance around psychiatry and psychiatric conditions, at least how they have been treated in the past. And before I have Dr. Walsh come with us, I just want to read an excerpt from his book, which is Nutrient Power, that to me is really quite profound. So let me just start here. Psychiatry has made impressive advances in the past 50 years, but needs a new direction. Today's emphasis on drug medications will not stand the test of time. Drugs have helped millions of people with depression and other mental disorders, but benefits usually are partial in nature and involve unpleasant or intolerable side effects. Medication therapy is more art than science and involves a considerable amount of trial and error. A fundamental limitation is that psychiatric drugs are foreign molecules that result in an abnormal condition rather than producing normalcy. It is unlikely that future psychiatric drugs will ever be universally effective or free of side effects. A new approach is needed. And we're going to talk about the new approach that Dr. Walsh has been dedicating his life to. So it's my great pleasure to welcome you to the show today, Dr. Walsh.
Well, it's my pleasure, Cheryl.
Well, I just want to say that in the world of psychiatric, you know, quote unquote psychiatric conditions and how people have been treated with these very powerful drugs, you know, and the areas that I have been investigating, and as a naturopathic doctor, it really fascinates me. As someone who personally has suffered from depression and anxiety in the past, it is a, you know, personal interest. And I just feel we have really been in the dark ages. And I think that what has really impressed me and drawn me to your work and to have you as a guest is because you are such a leading light in helping to really find our way out of the darkness and to really help people and understand that psychiatric conditions are not some curse that people have for some bizarre reason, but really have underlying causes that can be addressed and treated. So I guess I want to start by asking you, how did you take on this mission?
Well, actually, I was working as an experimental scientist as a young man. And I was working in things like physics and chemistry and doing – I was an experimentalist. And I worked at places like Argonne National Laboratory, Institute for Atomic Research in Ames. I worked in Los Alamos. And when I came to Illinois and settled down and working as a scientist at Argonne, I became a volunteer at a local prison, and I got I organized a group of about 125 volunteers, actually, trying to do what we could. Our aim was to try to reduce crime, and we thought the best way to do it was to go straight to the people most likely to commit a crime and do what we could to maybe persuade them or enable them not to commit crimes when they left prison. We started an ex-offender program working with people leaving prison because that's the time they really needed help. And that's when my education began. Back in those days, which is a long time ago, back in the early 70s, people thought that most mental disorders, including depression and schizophrenia and bipolar disorder, they thought the belief back then was that these were caused by life experiences, poor nurturing or traumatic events. And the psychiatry, mainly, the approach was to put these people on a couch, delve into their early history to try to find out what had gone wrong in their early development. Well, there was a revolution that started in the late 60s, early 70s. It's called the biochemical revolution in psychiatry. And what happened is that scientists around the world began to realize that the number one cause of problems like anxiety and depression was that a lot of it had to do with whether or not their parents or relatives had the same problem. They found that these things ran in families, and they were doing genetic studies of identical and fraternal twins. And anyway, they found out that it was really hard to be a psychiatrist in 1970. Can you imagine, after spending all that time in medical school and learning how to help your patients, that your profession comes to you and says, sorry, but everything we taught you was wrong. What's really wrong with these people is they have neurotransmission problems. They have it has to do with brain biochemistry and the biology of the brain. What happened at that time is the only way they knew how to change neurotransmitter function was drugs. And so that was they had to do this because it was the only way they could make a dent in these people, and it was far more effective and quicker, of course, than trying to delve into their life history. And we've been in this zone for about the last 50 years, the drug therapy mode, and I think we're beginning to emerge from it. Brain science has advanced so much, especially in the last 10 years, that we now are learning how to fix problems like depression, autism, behavior disorders, anxiety, using natural substances. And we don't necessarily have, as the science has advanced, the need for these drug medications is just gradually fading away, I believe. And I think in about 30, 40 years, people will look back on this and think, wow, why were these people, you know, doing all of this, all these drugs?
So because drug therapy is so common for just about any, you know, I guess psychiatric condition or mental imbalance or emotional imbalance, what, first of all, in your experience, are some of your concerns about the use of these drugs for people, whether it's people with schizophrenia or depression or anxiety or obsessive compulsive disorder? What have you seen out of your research that we need to be aware of if we take these medications?
Well, in balance, I have to first start by saying that I've met hundreds and hundreds of people who say that drug therapy and psychiatric meds have saved their lives and give them a better life. So I want to point that out. However, there are some things that really do bother me. For example, ADHD. ADHD, now we now know, according to the experts, Center for Disease Control, the incidence of ADHD is somewhere between 5% and 9%, depending on what, whose data you look at. There are entire cities, large cities, and even states in the union where more than 25% or 30% of kids are on medications for ADHD. So it's being overdiagnosed, and there's a lot of children who would have just been late bloomers who get started on drugs, stimulant drugs, or even more powerful drugs. At an early age, when they would have been perfectly okay if they had just been left alone. Another group that bothers me are the atypical antipsychotics that are used for psychosis conditions. Well, these are drugs like risperidone, clozaril. There's about 8 or 9 of them now, and they can effectively, very often, get rid of the psychosis. So a person who has delusions might lose the delusions, or a person who's hearing voices, the voices may fade away. But these drugs leave people in a terrible state, and very few of them are. I think the National Institute of Health is now saying only 14% of psychosis patients recover using these medications. Well, one of the abuses, and I do mean an abuse, is they are now using these atypical antipsychotic powerful medications on small children. There are tens of thousands of American children diagnosed with autism who are given risperidone or Abilify. These are really, really powerful medications, and these children, their little brains are still developing at this early age. There's been a lot of evidence now in the psychiatric literature and everywhere else that these very medications shrink the brain. They cause a reduction in the volume of the cortex of the brain, and yet they're giving it to young children. And they've only been studied for safety for people age 17 and above, and yet they're giving them to these small children. So that's an abuse, I think, that is really awful. So again, first of all, psychiatrists that I know, and I've known so many of them, they're very dedicated, and they're doing their very best to help their patients, but they need better weapons. Most of the psychiatrists I talk to do not like the fact that they only are allowed by insurance to talk to their patients for maybe a half an hour or an hour, and then the question is, what drug do we give them? They love our approach, and we have a number of psychiatrists that we've been training in our advanced nutrient therapy, and they like the fact that we are able to do blood work, simple and expensive blood tests and urine tests that can identify more sharply what's gone wrong in their brain, and to provide them with natural therapies, inviting vitamins, minerals, and amino acids that can normalize the brain many times.
So in your work with understanding, in my way of saying it would be the root cause issues that are generating these manifestations of imbalance, you have investigated, and I know you've worked with 30,000 patients, and you've got, I think, millions of, I think it was over 1 million histories on these patients or blood workup, or if I have that correct, you may need to correct
me.
We
have more than 5 million blood and urine lab results.
Oh, there you go.
And I think probably 30 or 40,000 case histories where the symptoms and traits are also related to these imbalances, and so it's all really useful for diagnosis. But we need to find out what a person's biochemical individuality is. If a person comes to us with anxiety, there's a number of possibilities biochemically, so we need to find out who they are biochemically and then normalize their chemistry.
So that's a point I really wanted to make, was that what you are doing is working with psychiatric conditions like other doctors, naturopaths would work with people who come with physical imbalances. Because the brain and the function of the brain is a symptom of some degree of imbalance that has occurred, nutritional deficiencies, that we'll talk about the epigenetics, the inherited tendency, the gene tendencies. But basically, it's a symptom, right? These manifestations of whatever their psychiatric condition is really just saying to us that something is out of balance, something is deficient, something is not being processed appropriately within our physiology, and that's what we have to investigate and normalize. Would you agree with that?
That's certainly true in most cases. There's a few exceptions. If a person has a head injury, it might be something we can't work with, but I'd say 98% of the mentally ill people we've seen, we can help.
Right. So that's what I find so exciting. And you work with such a spectrum, because you work with ADHD children, people with ADHD and autism, and then all the other, psychiatric conditions all the way over to the realm of Alzheimer's as well. You're covering quite a spectrum there of issues.
But actually, it's not as complicated as one might think. And the reason is that there are about six or seven major neurotransmitters that have a lot to do and are dominant in mental health. And when you look at nutrients, there are more than 300 important nutrients in the human body, but there are only about five or six that really dominate and impact mental functioning. And that's really convenient. So we don't have to do lab testing of 300 lab tests. We only have to look at a handful of symptoms in order to be able to help so many of these people.
So what are some of those basic nutrients that we should all be ensuring we take into our diet or with supplementation? What have you found?
Well, with respect to nutrients, there are both deficiencies and there are overloads. Because of genetics, nearly every human being, if you were to do a complete study of them, you would find out that they would have maybe a half a dozen or more important nutrients that because of genetics, they were very deficient in. So those people would benefit from many, many times the RDA of those nutrients because you're fighting genetics, and in order to normalize blood levels and brain levels, you'd have to give high doses perhaps. And that can be guided by blood work to normalize these. But the greatest mischief of all is because of overloads of nutrients. Most of us have, because of genetics, we have some nutrients that tend to be overloaded, and this can cause great mischief. High levels of iron, copper, folic acid, methionine, overloads of those can cause great mental problems. And so we can correct a lot of these problems by just normalizing them. And this is why you can't take a person with a serious brain problem and fix it by just stuffing them full of vitamins, minerals, and amino acids. You will probably do more harm than good because they may be suffering more from overloads of a nutrient than a deficiency. So it's really quite scientific, but not that complicated and not that difficult for a doctor to learn how to do this. For about $300 or $400, they can do a set of blood and urine tests, and that together with a medical history and learning about the patient and their symptoms and traits and family history can guide them to a nutrient therapy that can really help them.
What are your thoughts about nutrients like vitamin D and zinc? I know that when I test people, I see people extremely deficient in those two specifically.
Well, you're absolutely right. And fortunately, the mainstream medicine has recently discovered vitamin D, and now there's quite a few doctors, regular mainstream doctors, that are regularly checking for it because there are so many people that are low in vitamin D. I just saw a patient just yesterday whose vitamin D level was about 7, and wow. It should be between 40 and 60. And whenever I go to Norway, with their lack of sunlight up there, the whole population is low in vitamin D. And so that's something that I think is probably 70 or 80% of the population is low in vitamin D and would benefit from this inexpensive supplement of vitamin D. But probably the number one nutrient that we see in mental illness cases, whether it's depression, behavior disorders, autism, schizophrenia, or whatever, is zinc deficiency. Almost all of them, I'd say 90 to 95% of them, are either low normal or deficient in zinc. And a high percentage of them tell us that life gets a lot better once we normalize their zinc level.
And why is zinc so important?
Well, zinc is important for many things. It's a major antioxidant. It's involved directly in how your DNA works. It has a lot to do with making how the body makes enzymes and proteins. It's important for in a part of the brain called the hippocampus, and there's so much zinc in that part of your brain. It's almost like a mossy area of the brain, and it's needed for memory. It's needed for behavior control. It's needed for general health. If you're zinc deficient, you'd be more prone to things like cancer and to all kinds of immune problems. One of the more popular supplements now is, if, you know, there are a lot of supplements that provide zinc for things like people who think they're about to get a cold or just get their immune system benefiting. And that, and I think those things work. I think every human being really should be checked for zinc. Myself, zinc deficiency runs in my family. I take 100 milligrams of zinc a day.
Oh, wow.
And just enough to normalize my blood level of zinc.
Right. Because you need that much based on your biochemistry.
Yeah, I have a genetic tendency for strong zinc deficiency. And fortunately, I can test my plasma zinc every so often, and I can normalize it, and I think it really helps. Some people don't need any zinc. They get enough from their diet. The RDA is about 15 milligrams a day, but I need 100. And
right.
Most people with anxiety, depression, schizophrenia, violent children, almost all the violent kids we've seen, and I've seen more than 10, clinically, we've seen more than 10,000 cases of children and adults with terrible tempers and who would go into rages and have, you know, really serious behavior issues, including about 1,000 people that were convicted of felonies. And almost all of them are very zinc deficient. We've learned that we can turn around probably 3/4 of violent children just by simply normalizing their zinc and B6 levels.
You know, isn't that amazing? Because these violent children, poor things, I mean, they're just, they are having a physiological and, I guess, a behavioral reaction to a deficiency. It's not that they are dysfunctional or, you know, just traumatized. They just basically are expressing, their body is expressing something is seriously out of balance and easily and inexpensively addressed.
That's exactly right. And, for example, if a child is oppositional defiant disorder, a kid with a strong will and just oppositional to everything, and, of course, they're born that way, and it doesn't have a lot to do with nurturing, they are born with undermethylation. That's a biochemical imbalance that they were born with. It's heritable. It tends to run in families. And these kids, they could have a sibling, a brother, with different chemistry, and one will be, you know, really hard to parent, and the other one will be fine. But it's correctable. And then you can have a zinc deficiency, or you could have a pyrrole disorder. You could have inability to handle toxic metals. A lot of the behavior disordered people we see don't have the mechanism to cope with things like mercury and lead and other toxic metals, and that has a lot to do with their behavior. And that's also correctable.
You know, it's just it is such a new world. As this information and these modalities become more available, and you train more practitioners, there's so much suffering that can be alleviated, and trauma to individuals, trauma to families, trauma to communities.
There's an enormous amount of human misery out there.
And I would imagine that our modern world is really contributing to that. I mean, we have so much exposure to toxins, toxic metals. We have a nutrient-depleted diet. We have excessive stress levels. I mean, it's like a perfect storm that is activating these pathways and these manifestations, which is why we need your works. We can correct it if we know what to do.
There's a number of questions like, why do we have an epidemic of breast cancer? Why is there an epidemic of autism throughout the world? It's clear that these have to do with environmental insults.
You know, can we talk a little bit about the postpartum depression? I know that you have a lot to say about that and the cause behind that.
Yes, we've studied more than 3,000 cases of depression and maybe 700 or 800 cases of postpartum depression. We did a study that we published in a scientific journal, a peer-reviewed journal, a few years ago, where we compared the biochemistry of women who had children and had experienced postpartum depression, and then women who were pregnant, had children, and did not have depression. And the difference was copper and zinc. We found, especially copper, what happens during a pregnancy is that a woman's copper level more than doubles. And that's needed for the baby to develop, because you need copper for something called angiogenesis, which basically is the ability to rapidly create new blood vessels and capillaries, which the growing fetus needs. So the problem is that copper has a lot to do with the two neurotransmitters, dopamine and norepinephrine. And if your copper level's high, you will have too little dopamine and too much norepinephrine. They've done experiments with animals where they starve them of copper, and they could actually change the ratio of those two neurotransmitters by a factor of three, a gigantic change in this. Well, high norepinephrine causes extreme anxiety and depression. And we believe it's quite clear now that virtually everyone with postpartum depression is likely to have an overload of copper. Now, we have a system in the body. We're supposed to have a system that gets rid of excess copper. It's called homeostasis. And so if we're a healthy person with all of our systems functioning, excess copper is quickly eliminated from the body by a protein called metallothionein and with the help of one called glutathione. Some women don't have that ability. So after a child is born, their sky-high copper level results in sky-high norepinephrine activity and this condition of postpartum depression, and in some cases, postpartum psychosis. And we find that they're very easy to correct. These are one of our most successful populations. More than 90% of these patients tell us that after normalizing their copper, that they're, for the first time in a while, they are completely okay and they can throw away their medications. This is what they report to us. So that's one example of a nutrient therapy. I wish all of the mental problems were that easy to correct.
And that's by just adding something like a zinc supplement to help normalize that zinc-copper ratio, which I know they have a relationship, zinc and copper.
They do, and actually zinc and copper are related because zinc has a lot to do with the homeostasis of copper and the regulation of copper. And so you have to do it carefully. You don't dare give a postpartum depressed female a large amount of zinc all at once because it would cause too much copper to suddenly rush out of the body. And so what happens if you make that mistake is that their symptoms would get worse because they're for temporarily, while the excess copper is leaving the scene, their blood levels would get really, really high and they would feel even worse. So we have to do it gradually and carefully. And these things really should be done under the care of an experienced doctor or naturopath.
Right. So this is where when women with postpartum depression talk about these issues, do they go to their OBGYN? Do they go to a psychiatrist? Well, who's treating these women with postpartum depression?
Well, what I've learned is that, unfortunately, they're usually given SSRIs together with counseling. Well, the counseling can maybe help them a bit, but the SSRIs, we've learned, have zero effect on these people. Last May, I was invited to the American Psychiatric Association annual meeting to talk about the research and the types of depression. We have this huge chemistry database for depression, and we've learned that depression is a name, it's an umbrella term that is given for at least five completely different conditions, each one of them involving different neurotransmitter problems, and each one requiring a completely different treatment. Well, one of these five groups, 17% of all the people that we've seen with depression are the people who are, we call it high copper depression or copper overload depression. And that includes all of the postpartum depression cases and also quite a few other women with either depression, anxiety, or bipolar disorder. The thing we've learned is that they probably shouldn't be calling it postpartum depression. We find that anxiety is even more serious than the depression they suffer from. I think they should call it postpartum anxiety. But that's one of the five types of depression, and it's important for psychiatrists to find out what kind of depression a person has, and because they are very different. Now, two of the five types do, in fact, have low serotonin activity as a basic problem. And these are the ones who do quite nicely on SSRIs. But then we have the copper overload depressives, and nothing good or bad happens if they get an SSRI. We find 20% of all depressives actually have too much serotonin activity to begin with because of a genetic problem. And these are the people who get worse on SSRIs. And we think that has a lot to do with the school shootings that have happened in Columbine and in Connecticut recently.
I was going to ask you if they're the ones that either commit suicide or go on rampages and are in these altered states.
Yeah, and I reported this at the APA meeting to the World Psychiatrists. There were 17,000 psychiatrists at this meeting. And basically, I've studied more than 10,000 cases of behavior disorders and people who are violent and criminals and violent kids, and they're completely different from the school shooters. If you look at the histories, most of the people with behavior problems, their behaviors are usually clearly different by the time they're 2 or 3 years old. The kids who did the school shootings, there have been more than 50 cases in the last 20 years, and these have been studied intensively, and we find that more than 40 out of the 50 were kids who were okay, didn't really have a behavior issue. Until they were in their teen years, they developed anxiety and depression and were given an SSRI, and then disaster happened soon afterwards. I'm quite convinced that most of these cases of school shootings involved inappropriate use of an SSRI medication.
Right. I agree.
And so I mentioned to the psychiatrist that I urged them, before they ever give an antidepressant to a teenage boy, to first do some simple lab work to identify the ones who will be intolerant to it. I think that's the fastest way to stop school shootings. I don't think we're going to be able to accomplish it as a society by getting rid of the guns. We have more than 300 million guns in America, and I don't think it's going to be achieved by trying to identify people who shouldn't have a gun. I don't think that's going to work at all. I think the way to do it quickly would just be to do some inexpensive lab work and not give SSRIs to these vulnerable people.
Thank you for joining me. You're listening to What Women Must Know, and today we're talking to Dr. William Walsh. He is the author of Nutrient Power, Heal Your Biochemistry, and Heal Your Brain. And we're exploring what I am calling the more enlightened understanding of brain chemistry and how to address the many conditions that are affecting so many of us these days, everything from ADHD, autism, to schizophrenia, depression, anxiety, Alzheimer's, and just about everything in between. So I wanted to ask you, Dr. Walsh, before the break we were talking about the issues of SSRIs and how 20% of the population who manifest depression have an overabundance of serotonin, which leads to suicide and homicidal behaviors and actions. What about the role of the gut? Because supposedly, from everything I've been taught, up to 80% of our neurotransmitters are made in our gut. What is the role of our gut health and the ability to produce these neurotransmitters and our mental and emotional states?
It's true that a huge amount of our serotonin is produced in our gut. However, none of that serotonin ever reaches the brain. All of the serotonin that functions inside the brain is created in the brain. And so we have these neurotransmitters throughout the body, but what's going on in the brain is quite different from the rest of the body.
Oh, that's so interesting. So it doesn't make it into our, it doesn't impact our brain chemistry.
No, and you can have an overload of, say, a deficiency of serotonin in the periphery of your body, and in your brain, it could be quite different. And in fact, the synthesis of serotonin, there's one process that's the same in both places, but there's a shade of difference. And so you can't really confidently do any tests of neurotransmitters in your blood or your urine and be confident that that's going on in your brain too.
Wow. So what do the neurotransmitters do in that are produced in our gut? What's their function?
Oh, they are absolutely essential. We need all of these neurotransmitters, whether it's serotonin or whatever. It's involved in the whole digestive process. It's part of the key biochemistry of human functioning.
That to me is a really interesting piece of information I didn't know. I didn't know that it has really no impact on the brain chemistry. It has an impact on our other aspects of our biochemistry, but not crossing into the brain.
It can make you, if you have a serotonin imbalance in your gut, you can become sick. You might have digestive problems. You might have immune problems. And that can make you depressed. It might affect your neurotransmitters, but not in a direct way.
Right. So I guess the next question I would ask is what is it that helps support and optimize our neurotransmitters? Can we address nutrition? We talked about the role of vitamin D and the role of zinc. Is there anything else that people need to be aware of to help to nourish their brain chemistry?
Well, there are three areas that we can use. First of all, the question is, where do our neurotransmitters come from? Where does serotonin come from? Where do we get dopamine and norepinephrine and acetylcholine and all these, really important brain chemicals that dominate mental functioning? Well, the raw materials come from nutrients. They're synthesized in the brain and throughout the body, and now scientists have worked out exactly how this happens, what chemicals come together, and they call them the precursors, but really the ingredients that we need to come together to make serotonin and the other neurotransmitters are amino acids, vitamins, and minerals. So if a person happens to have a genetic deficiency or overload in one of those key chemicals, one of those key nutrients, you can expect they're going to have a problem with their brain function, and they do. So part of this, is to correct and normalize the amounts of these important neurotransmitters. Now, another issue, though, is we've learned that it's not so much the amount of serotonin in the brain that's important, it's reuptake. That's something that the university and pharmacology scientists learned in about the 1980s. They've learned that it's really not how much serotonin you've got that really matters. It's how fast do you get reuptake. In other words, if a brain cell fires and serotonin is injected into the synapse, there's a mechanism by which the serotonin can rush back into that original cell. And it goes in through passageways called transport proteins or transporters. And what really dominates is the amount and the functioning of these transporters. Well, that's where epigenetics comes in. So we're not working quite so much at giving people tryptophan and things like that which can do some benefit, but the real name of the game is reuptake. And we've learned that because of the emerging science of epigenetics, we can actually do something we never could do before. Up until the last 5 or 6 years, nutritional scientists, naturopaths, we've not been able to have a patient that we can adjust their enzymes. See, a lot of our important chemicals are made in the body from food, but some of the really important chemicals and enzymes that have a lot to do with functioning throughout the body involve genetic expression. We've got about 23,000 genes, every one of us. Every gene's got one job, and that's to make one particular protein or enzyme. Well, what epigenetics is a natural and process necessary to health. And during the first month in the womb, the little tiny fetus has a process whereby tissue by tissue, liver, kidney, different parts of your body, you need different chemicals that are genetically expressed. And that's done by epigenetics, by the placement of methyl groups at key places along your DNA, which can turn off the genes you don't want. So you get the right mix of nutrients everywhere in the body. Well, that... We've learned now that we are able to adjust genetic expression, and for the first time, we're able to actually tailor enzyme levels that we never could do before. And this is something very new and very exciting. And also, we now have a deeper understanding of how to use natural substances to using these epigenetic gene regulation methods to actually fix neurotransmitter levels. In other words, if a person is low in serotonin, they need a reuptake inhibitor, and that's what SSRIs do. Well, now we know that there are natural substances that are, for example, SAMe and methionine. These are over-the-counter nutrients. They are serotonin reuptake inhibitors. And the one difference is that it takes a bit longer for them to take effect. It takes about 2 months to accomplish what the medication can do in a couple of days, but there are no side effects. And in effect, we can be normalizing the brain instead of using a foreign molecule that will have side effects. So the third part of this, so there's the first part was to provide the nutrients needed to actually make the neurotransmitters in the first place, and then the nutrient therapy that we can, by using epigenetic science, we can regulate and control neurotransmission, how much, you know, serotonin activity or dopamine activity or whatever. The third part is oxidative stress. Every single condition that we've talked about so far, whether it's behavior, autism, or whatever, every single one of them involves elevated oxidative stress, free radicals that can really mess up mental functioning or human functioning. So antioxidant therapy is really valuable to virtually everyone, and we provide that to every patient we see. We make sure they get plenty of vitamin C and vitamin E and vitamin A and vitamin D, especially if they need it. But the antioxidants are especially necessary. Zinc is probably the most important antioxidant of all. The number one antioxidant in the body is considered to be glutathione, but that is made from food, and a good diet can produce the glutathione you need to protect you against these oxidative free radicals. So that basically summarizes it. And the people that I find, the doctors that we train, the ones that seem most excited about this are the psychiatrists, because now they've got another weapon in their armor, you know, in their arsenal. They may still use medications as they can to help their patients, but now they've got something else that can really help them. And they tell me, you know, a year or two later, that now they've got patients that they can help that they couldn't help before by using advanced nutrient therapy.
So, the question I have, let's talk about the serotonin deficiency, and if you take SAMe and some of these other nutrients, you can naturally increase serotonin levels. Because this seems to be an inherited condition based on gene expressions, I would assume that if this is the case, it would really be important for a person to continue with that nutritional support long term. Is that accurate? Or
you're absolutely right, and it's one of the issues is that we can usually we can often correct a problem, but we can't cure it, and it's really kind of sad. We have we've had hundreds and hundreds of patients over the years who told us that their behavior or their depression or anxiety had been completely resolved. And then years later, we find they're in terrible trouble again. And what happened is they stopped compliance, and it came back. So unfortunately, these are conditions in almost every case where they tend to come back if you stop the treatment.
I do nutrigenomic testing, so I'm very fascinated by the world of epigenetics. And just knowing what I've inherited, there are certain nutrients that I really can't be without. Otherwise, I'd be at risk. So I understand that there are certain things that really are required to support our optimal health, because that's just our genomic makeup that we came in with.
Yes, and that genomic makeup tells us a lot about what we need to do to be healthy. In my case, I've had Carl Pfeiffer and other people test my blood and tell me what my biochemistry was years and years ago. I know that I have a genetic tendency for zinc deficiency. I'm very undermethylated, and which means I do really well on things like methionine or SAMe. I have to avoid folates, folic acid, and I have to make sure I don't get too much green leafy vegetables because of epigenetics. The folates would help improve my methylation, but they would affect my brain function because of the epigenetic effect. Folates are serotonin reuptake promoters. In other words, they go in the wrong direction for people who have any tendency at all for depression, if they're low serotonin people.
Yeah, well, this is so fascinating and gets very complicated, which is why you're training practitioners to help each person individualize their protocol, which...
One thing that I thought was the biggest barrier to this whole field is that most people in society and most doctors and scientists don't realize how powerful nutrients can be, but they have great power, and that's why the title of my book is Nutrient Power. That's the message I want people, the society, and psychiatry experts to realize, that there is great power there. And our book is now available on our website. Our website, by the way, is walshinstitute.org, O-R-G, since we're a public charity. And so the book can be obtained from that or from Barnes & Noble or from Amazon or whatever. And I think that would provide a lot of information about what we're doing, and also resources. We list the labs that can capably do the inexpensive testing that can identify a person's, what direction they need to go in. And also we have a list of on our website. We're updating it actually right now to list on the doctors in the USA and around the world that are capable of doing this. Because I think it should be done, should be supervised by a doctor or a naturopath, a practitioner who is familiar with this approach.
Do you think neurotransmitter testing is effective?
Unfortunately, it's not as effective as we would like. You can't directly test neurotransmitters in the brain, and nobody would like you to stick a needle in there to pull out something to test. And trying to test the metabolites, the fluids that depart the brain through the spine, that doesn't work very well either. I know it's very popular to test now. We have the ability to test serotonin, dopamine, and other neurotransmitters both in urine and in the blood, and serotonin kinetics and platelets has been interesting, but I there's not a great correlation, so it has limited value, I believe.
Okay, that's really interesting. I'm glad I asked that question. In the time we have left, can we talk about what you are learning in regards to Alzheimer's?
Yes. Basically, when it all started with autism research, I was the great Bernie Rimland about 15 years ago learned that my clinic was seeing more autistics than anybody in the world. And he had us asked us to come to his DAN group, the organization he had. And we had a think tank with people, maybe 50 or 60 experts from around the world, brainstorming all the mysteries of autism and how to help these kids. And what I had learned is that they all had a problem with a protein called metallothionein. And the reason is that they all had a failure to normalize copper and zinc. And they also had especially a tendency to have a lot of free radical copper, which isn't supposed to happen. So based on that, I developed a formulation that would promote metallothionein. And it would promote the genetic expression and promote the functioning of it. And it's a formulation of 22 nutrients. And I got all of there were more than 1,000 articles on metallothionein protein that came out of Alzheimer's literature. And the reason is two different groups have found that in studying the brains of people who died, doing cadaver studies of people who had Alzheimer's compared to those who died of something else, the difference was extraordinary deficiencies of this metallothionein protein. Well, the metallothionein protein is a fabulous antioxidant. It's a important part. Has a lot to do with brain development, and it also has a lot to do with the blood-brain barrier that protects the brain from the things that aren't supposed to get in the brain. Well, we've given this therapy now to thousands and thousands of autistic kids, and the families report often that they get a really nice improvement. Not every time, but very often. Well, I decided to patent this, and the reason was even though we're a public charity, we wanted to make sure that somebody else couldn't patent it and rip people off by charging huge amounts of money for it. We started trying this as a trial on people diagnosed with dementia, with Alzheimer's, and what we found was very surprising to us. What we found was that the first five or six people, most of the families said that there was a partial improvement. Actually, part of the memory came back. There were the first woman we did that had no longer knew her grandkids, but after a couple of months on this metallothionein promotion therapy, which really is just a formulation of nutrients, they said that her not only did she now know her grandkids again, but her personality had come back and she was enjoying life better. And then what most of them tell us is that then they stabilize. The Alzheimer's, if you actually have Alzheimer's and get diagnosed, it's actually a death sentence, which is really unfortunate, and it's not a very pleasant death. And the median time between diagnosis and death is 7 years. And and the medications they use for Alzheimer's do nothing to stop the constant death of brain cells. The medications simply enable the dying brain to function better as it's dying. So we now have done about 200 people, and I have to say it's still unproven. There are no double-blind studies behind this. And also, we don't know for sure. You never know if somebody truly has Alzheimer's or there are other kinds of dementia like Lewy body disorders or vascular dementia. But what we do know is that of the couple hundred that we have done and got results from, about 70% tell us that that they get a partial improvement followed by stabilization. And then what happens to most of them is their doctor eventually tells them that their Alzheimer's was misdiagnosed, that they never had it, I think because they didn't deteriorate and die. So that's really promising, but it's not proven. And we're not really out there publishing articles on it yet because we need more information. We need to do more science to make sure that it works.
Well, I know people listening to what you've just shared will want to know about that supplement. Is it available?
It is. The supplement is available, but not widely known. The doctors we train are given the formulation. It's actually something you have to be very careful to use. The first time we put the formulation together, before we gave it to autistic children, or to Alzheimer's patients, we wanted to know if it could harm anybody. So we thought if we were going to kill somebody, it should be one of us. So I got five volunteers in my clinic who volunteered to take this supplement, this MT promotion supplement, and we tested their biochemistry on a Friday, asked them all to take one of these large capsules every day. And then in 2 weeks, we're going to retest their chemistry and find out if they'd had any side effects. Well, at the very next Monday, just 3 days later, one by one, they started coming to me telling me that they had to stop. And the reason was the first woman that contacted me said her husband made her stop because she was getting too bitchy. Hmm. And then a really calm, wonderful nurse told me that her teenagers were begging her to stop because she was getting too irritable. And we learned that that you have to give it very cautiously. You cannot give that formulation to anybody who has any level of zinc deficiency, because when this when this metallifying protein is expressed, if you suddenly shower the body with it, the first thing it does is it grabs on to 7 atoms of zinc, and you can get temporary zinc deficiency. So it's not something we want to get out into the public and have people just taking it on their own. The process is 2 steps. You have to first make sure that you have adequate amounts of zinc, and that often takes about a month or two, and then you cautiously, gradually introduce this formulation. But there are a lot of doctors that know how to do this, and there are some of them listed in both my book, Nutrient Power, and also in our website.
Okay, well, that's I know that question was going on everyone's mind listening, so I'm glad you answered that really thoroughly. Dr. Welsh, we've come to the end of our conversation, which has gone really quickly. Look, it has been such an honor and a delight to have you on the show. You're just such a light out there in the world, and I want to thank you for your dedication and the great work you're doing. I've learned a lot, so it's been an absolute pleasure to have you with us today.
Well, thank you very much.
And to all my listeners, thank you for joining us for another fantastic conversation. We'll be back next week. And remember, always honor the wisdom of your feminine self. Bye for now.